why, I mean, why would you walk into a bank with a sawn-off shotgun when you can make hundreds of millions of dollars sitting across a border in some country that's got rather loose regulations and commit crimes anywhere else in the world?
How can I help? How can I be useful in ending needless suffering? Do not be afraid of work that has no end.
We have to organize a social movement.
We have an opportunity to lead by example versus just talking hot air. I think the more people in this fight, the more we grow. Eventually, you could change. You know, the people are the ones that can make the change.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Change Agents, an Ironclad original presented by Montana Knife Company. Let's talk about the internet today. And by that, I mean your information, your data on the internet. We're going to talk about TikTok. We're going to talk about cybersecurity. We're going to talk about the companies and countries who can access your most private data, what you can do about it, the control measures that you may have, and kind of the worst case scenario if these entities or individuals are able to access your data. My guest for that today is Professor Alan Woodward. He is one of the world's leading cybersecurity experts, whose research extends to covert communications and forensic computing. He has previously worked for the government of the United Kingdom and currently advises Europol through the European Center for Cybercrime, the EC3, as well as private sector companies. He is a fellow of the British Computer Society, the Institute of Physics, and the Royal Statistical Society. Today, he is a visiting professor at the University of Surrey Center for Cybersecurity, Computer Science Research Center. That is quite a mouthful. So let's lay the groundwork here a little bit with the internet ecosystem. Specifically, TikTok currently has over 1 billion monthly active users. That's more than 20% of all internet users. The EU, UK, Canada, and the US are among some countries that have the TikTok app restricted from government-owned devices. According to a recent study, total damages caused by cybercrimes in 2022 reached more than $6 trillion. Not billion, not million, $6 trillion. And according to the FBI, at least 422 million individuals were impacted by cybercrimes in 2022. According to the online security platform Astra, more than 2,300 cybercrimes are thought to occur each day.
Oh, gosh, yes. I've got a slightly checkered past.
Don't we all?
My family have always been in the military. But when it came to me, it was the Cold War. So I ended up working for various civilian agencies. And one of the, I mean, it turned out that I wasn't very good at building computer systems, but I was quite good at breaking into them certainly finding out how they broke. And that's how I got into it, working for the government. Then in 1991, I think it was, they decided they didn't need people like me anymore because the threat had all gone away. Russia was all friendly now. And the wall came down. We went off and started a business. Again, just we were doing it for banks and things like that. And then guess what? The threat hadn't gone away. It just changed. So we started hiring ourselves back at exorbitant rates to do exactly the same things we have been as civil servants. So I've been in it for a long, 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 ever since my postgraduate days. I started off as a physicist, but my postgraduate research was in signal processing. Which was the beginnings of getting into what was called InfoSec, but is now cybersecurity.
And what role are you currently holding now? I was looking through your bio, and it'd be better off if you explained it as opposed to me attempting to explain it.
Yeah, well, I'm a professor of cybersecurity at the University of Surrey, and what's called the Faculty of Engineering and Physical Sciences, very long term. But we have in the UK. DCHQ, which is the equivalent of NSA in the States, they have a number of what's called, it's a very highfalutin term, but it's academic centers of excellence. They started off with seven of us, I think, and now there's 13, and they have different tiers. Ours, the Surrey Centre for Cybersecurity, is one of these ACEs. And we conduct research into all sorts of areas. Ours is, we are a proper computer science department. So an awful lot of it is in the more esoteric areas like encryption and the like. And I have a particular interest in some other areas as well of computer science, like quantum computing.
I know we're going to talk specifically about a few things, you know, social media, apps, TikTok, things of that nature. Broadly, at what velocity are the cybersecurity threats presenting themselves? Is it linear or is it just exponential as technology increases as well?
It kind of depends what you mean by the rate at which they're presenting themselves. In terms of just numerically, the number, it's exponential. But of those, by far and away, the single biggest threat is ransomware. And until very recently, I was an external advisor to Europol, which is the European Police Organization Coordination Organization in what's called the European Center for Cybercrime. And we produce a threat assessment every year, the Internet Organized Threat Assessment, a very snappy title. But it has been for a number of years the single biggest threat, because what's emerged is a whole ecosystem called crime as a service. And you don't need to be technically savvy at all. There's probably only a couple of hundred of them out there that are actually technically savvy. But the ones that used to be into drug dealing and prostitution and all the rest of it, it's much easier now just to go to get this crime as a service, pay somebody to set up some ransomware for you and launch it. And some of these campaigns make hundreds of millions of dollars. So why would you walk into a bank with a sawn-off shotgun when you can make hundreds of millions of dollars sitting across a border in some country that's got rather loose regulations and commit crimes anywhere else in the world? So unfortunately, it's increasing exponentially like that. What we're seeing is kind of, in terms of the type of threat, we're seeing sort of leaps. And the next biggest one, that the sort of predicted one, is actually going to be through AI, because I'm sure most people have heard of ChatGPT. Yes. But you can actually go to ChatGPT, and if you have some code that you want to attack, you certainly used to be able to. I'm not sure about now, but you used to be able to ask ChatGPT to analyze the code, find any vulnerabilities, and write you some code to exploit it. And it would do it within about 10 seconds. So again, why, you don't need any technical capabilities to do that. And you certainly don't need a degree in computer science. So that's my next biggest fear, that there'll be a proliferation of that. And it'll be rather like that crime as a service, only it's kind of self-service. You just do it yourself for nothing.
Yeah, I think, and I say this from a completely uneducated perspective, that we're going to be working for robots far sooner than we would like to. The Terminator T-1000, I don't think it's going to end up looking like that, but man, it's a bleak landscape out there for people like myself who are peripherally aware of the things that you're talking about, but don't have that deep level of knowledge and understanding.
I think the problem about what AI is going to do to us, and I say do to us, it's going to be almost a sort of a subliminal change, and it's already happening. Take the UK, because obviously I can give you examples in the UK. We have a government department called the Department of Work and Pensions, and they're the ones that decide on who gets what social benefits. And a lot of what the decision making that's done in there is what's called algorithmic based decision making. And it's, you just feed in various data points and the computer tells you what the answer is. And they're thinking very hard at the moment about how do they regulate that? How do they stop everything becoming, just automated? Because you get to the point where the human doesn't understand the algorithm, and it therefore you don't know whether the answer's right or wrong. And that has to be ethically wrong. And again, I'm blowing the trumpet of my university, but we've set up, there's another institute that we've set up, funded by government, amongst others, called the Human-Centered AI Institute. And it's looking at things like the ethics and the regulation of it, rather than just the technology, because so many people are looking at the technology and they're rushing ahead so fast that they're not... that. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. And they're not thinking like that. They're just thinking, all right, I need to be next. And the one that shocked me most this week was a paper that came out in, I was asked to review it, in Nature. And what they've now done, it was a collection of American universities. They have, and they've been doing this for a while, they've been growing what's called organoids. And these organoids are living cells, and they're grown from stem cells, embryonic stem cells, and they turn them into neurons. So the cells you find in your brain, and they're building small neural networks. So rather than artificial neural networks, we're now getting organic neural networks, and they have demonstrated how you can interface to that. And this is just all becoming, to me, slightly nightmarish. I mean, I can't imagine the ethics board that sat and said, this is a good idea. You know, yeah, let's go and do this. And they were able, for example, they actually, they developed a thing called BrainAware, which was a sort of software that allowed them to interface to this organoid. And I would say it doesn't think in the same, it's an organic computing device, but it is from human brain cells. And they set it a task, which was to recognize certain Japanese vowels. And it did it with something like 80% accuracy. So, you know, they had to keep it alive as such. You know, they had to blow carbon dioxide on it and keep it at a certain temperature and bathe it in this, that, and the other. But the reason they were doing it was because actually it turned out to be far more efficient and effective than the silicon-based one. Just to put it in perspective, the sort of, I mean, you're talking about megawatts being necessary to run the sort of hardware that's needed for ChatGPT. Yeah, we're talking about data centers. Yeah. A whole human brain only takes 20 watts. It's less than a light bulb. So yeah, you can see how, I can see why they were interested in doing it, but it's that question about should we be doing it? So, some of these things surprise even me.
Well, from somebody who doesn't live in this world, and I receive information about these things through traditional media sources, social media sources, whatever it may be, conversations like this, I'm pulled in a variety of different directions. I'm fascinated by humans' ability to push the leading edge of what we think is possible. And I'm so happy to hear that there are people who are looking at the ethics of this. But I also know that this is going to be viewed by either individuals or entities or countries as an arms race. So for every organization that is out there that is viewing this from an ethical perspective, how many are out there who actually don't care about the ethics? They want to be the first one to cross the threshold of the atomic bomb. And then that leads me deeper down into the rabbit hole of, well, at some point, do we lose control of this? Does it truly become an arms race? And do we start developing these things to a point where we pass a threshold where we could no longer pull it back, even if we wanted to?
Well, even countries that are thinking about the ethics of it, I mean, the sort of thing that worries me, we're slightly off topic here, but the sort of thing that worries me is you take a very recent example that we've all been affected by, which is the microbiologists and the virologists looking at what's called gain of function research, where they take a standard virus like a coronavirus, and they see how they can make it more potent. Now, that gain of function research was unethical and considered unethical in the United States, but it was done in the Wuhan Research Institute, but supported.
And we would never fund that, of course.
States.
Yeah, we would never fund that. We would not.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary. You just offshore it. I mean, you think...
No, we didn't do that. Where did this check go to? We don't want to talk about the check, but we didn't physically have our hands in it.
So I'm deeply cynical about a lot of these things, because I think if it's possible, somebody's going to do it.
Yes. Do you think there is a threshold that will be crossed where it can no longer be unwound? To me, I think of, for whatever, and maybe I'm not alone in this, a lot of the way that I view the world is through my references of movies, and things that you see in movies. And I'm not saying I think they're like a documentary, but I'm trying to remember the actual name of the movie where the machine asks him, "Shall we play a game?" And in the end, it starts playing tic-tac-toe.
Yeah, that's war games, that is.
War games. You know, I think at the end of that, it kind of turned itself off, or they had at least a point in time where it hadn't crossed this threshold where it couldn't be reversed. Yeah. Is it possible that it gets to a place where we no longer can actually turn it off?
It's known as the singularity in the field, and it's basically where the computing, a silicon-based or an artificial neural network, an artificial intelligence, becomes more intelligent than a human being. But you've got to be quite careful, because one of the interesting things about computers are they're incredibly deterministic. They do exactly what you ask them to do, and they will solve the problem you've given it. Not necessarily in the way you thought they were going to do it, but general artificial intelligence is a whole other thing. And I think we're a lot further away from that than from... You know, the chat GPTs, where it's extremely useful and it looks like it's intelligent, but actually what it's doing is a lot of data processing very, very fast. The problem is, if you give artificial intelligence, like deep neural networks, deep learning networks, if you give them control of something, that would be a big mistake. That's where the regulation needs to come in. There was you're too young to remember a very interesting film from the 70s called The Forbin Project, where they set up a computer, they gave it control, like in war games, gave it control of the nuclear arsenal and said, keep the people of the United States safe. And it did by basically threatening to launch the weapons unless they destroyed all the weapons.
Interesting.
That's the problem. When with artificial intelligence, it's not like the old algorithms. It will sometimes surprise you with the way it solves a problem you give it. And that's why until and unless we fully understand a particular algorithm or a particular neural network, we mustn't give it control of anything. Ultimately we've got to be able to just pull out the plug. Because we are getting to the point where ChatGPT has billions of nodes in it. No human can ever understand mm-hmm. how it's thinking. But if you were to give it control of something, I think that would be where disaster could lie that way. Because you could ask it to do something to control something in a certain way, or to undertake a certain task, and it wouldn't necessarily know. I mean, we've got examples actually happen as we speak, with Tesla having had to recall all of its cars because of its autopilot. And there's a very interesting video which was taken from the rear camera of one Tesla, where a Tesla swerved to miss one Tesla and crashed into another Tesla on the freeway. It's that old thing about, imagine a car driving automatically is heading for a group of people and it can swerve to avoid them. But in swerving to avoid them, it will kill one person. What does it do? And it will probably do the right thing and it killed the one person. But being humans, we think there must be some other solution where nobody gets killed. And unfortunately, I think we're going to be disappointed in some of the decisions it makes and some of the actions it takes.
If you were a betting man, mm-hmm. what would you put the timeline on that singularity occurring to be?
It's a bit like the same question. I'm often asked the same question about quantum computing. Now, I was doing my postgraduate research from 83 to 86. And then quantum computing was 10 years away. And it's always been 10 years away. And I think the same thing is true of that. It's not as close as people think. I mean, it's rather like computing in general. People tend to look at it and think, you know, the evolution from the original Colossus in Bletchley Park through to where we are now. They think, God, you know, that's miraculous. All the miniaturization, et cetera, that's gone on, and the fact that Moore's law, you know, it's doubled in capacity every 18 months. It has actually taken decades to get to where we are now. I remember when I first started in computing, it was the size of a room. You know, you had whole rooms given over to these things, and they needed chilled water and special air conditioning and a high priestess who would come to a hole in the wall, and you would give them something, cards to go and program the thing with. And then maybe a day later, you'd get the answer back. You know, people are, I hate to say it, being a gray-haired old professor, but youngsters today don't actually understand how far we really have come. But what it was like only 30, 40 years ago. But it's the bit about computing is, and it's the same with AI, it's accelerating. So it's not just getting faster, it's getting faster and faster. And that's where you can't quite predict. So everybody always says, oh, it's 10 years away. And then suddenly something will happen. In quantum computing, good example, is Microsoft. Actually, the Microsoft team they took a very different approach to quantum computing, a thing called topological quantum computing. And it could run at room temperature, et cetera, but it was dependent upon finding a thing called a quasi particle that hadn't yet been found. And people said, well, yeah, so we'll carry on and use our superconductors over here. We'll carry on with that. Then somebody, a Dutch physicist, found it. And suddenly it changed the game. So it's one of those things where things don't seem necessarily possible. A discovery is made in a completely different field, and then suddenly it changes computing. And that's what I suspect will happen with artificial intelligence. And it may be, for example, instead of artificial neural networks, these organoids, these organic neural networks, suddenly somebody finds a way of scaling those massively, and you know, it just takes off.
Yeah, it's hard to forecast into the future. I'm glad that you talked about how everything was 10 years away for the last 100 years. I think that's important for people to remember. And, you know, it's a good segue, though, to something that I think everybody is dealing with now and trying to figure out what to deal with, and that is social media. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about this conversation and a good way to even enter into this conversation before we connected today, because I hear a lot of people arguing that, well, it shouldn't exist. And the reality is we're through the looking glass.
Yeah.
Social media does exist. My children, I have a 15-year-old, an 18-year-old, and a 20-year-old. I'll say this. I'm glad that I did not have social media growing up. They are navigating a terrain and ecosystem and topography that I don't think I would have had the capability to do at their age. And I'm not actually sure that they do well either. They're navigating the terrain in front of them. But I think it's more a matter of how we manage it. And I know that there are security issues, to tie right back into your specialty of cybersecurity. One of them that I've heard in the previous election in 2020, and that I know we're going to hear more about in 2024, is TikTok. And surprisingly, I live in Montana, a state that I'm pretty sure passed legislation to ban the use of TikTok, which they also have banned speeding, but yet people are speeding every day. So I'd love to know how they plan to to prevent people from doing so. I understand the concept, and I believe it was tied directly back to the security based off of the company that actually created TikTok, ByteDance, and their relationship with the Chinese government. So could you unpack that just a little bit?
There's several parts to it. I would say right up front, I don't think there's any evidence that TikTok is a threat to anybody's national security as such. But there were two very interesting reports, detailed reports done. One by a group called Citizen Lab, a Canadian group who are, I trust them implicitly myself. And another one was one of the universities in the United States. And they went down to the code and they actually got the code, mostly for Android phones, because you can reverse engineer that code. And they had a good old look at what was going on. And you could trace the provenance of what had happened. And the original software was an application called Douyin, which I'm probably not pronouncing that correctly, but it was established specifically for China. And then ByteDance wanted to move out of China and move abroad. So they bought a company called Musical.ly. And what you see in TikTok, which is their overseas version of Douyin, if you like, is sort of a conflagration of Douyin code and Musical.ly code, etc. And it's not that it's not stealing any more information than you give to Facebook or anything like that. But the real problem with any Chinese application, an application that's run by a company based in China, is that the Chinese government, in their infinite wisdom, they passed a law in 2017 called the Intelligence Act. And what that does is means that any company, any Chinese company, any Chinese individual has to cooperate with the state agencies and has to keep it secret if they're told to. So there is, ever since, there has been this distrust. In the UK, we had a very interesting example with Huawei, where Huawei was about to start supplying equipment into our 5G networks. And it had just been banned in the United States. And we actually had here a specialist unit, which was staffed quite mostly with ex-GCHQ staff, analyzing right down to the firmware, the nuts and bolts, the tin in these boxes that were going to go in there. And they couldn't find anything, and there was no problem. Mm-hmm. And then what they found was what was described at the time as sloppy engineering, because what was being delivered to the manufacturing to be shipped to us wasn't what actually they'd supplied for us to evaluate. So kind of what was the point of it? I don't think there was any malintent. I think they were just sloppy. It was poor engineering. So the UK government said, well, we can't have that. So that they just pulled it. So Huawei weren't allowed to supply. And I think some of what people find in some of this code are sort of vestiges or things that had been done in the past or may have been done for censorship in China. They're still there, but they're kind of turned off. So you've got stubs of code that are not doing things anymore. There's no reason to suppose it couldn't be turned on, of course. But the kind of information you're actually giving to them is really not that valuable. I mean, as I said, go to Facebook and their terms and conditions say, you agree that all the data you put on our platform can be sold. They're quite open about it. But of course, everybody with the Chinese-based applications, everybody's got this. They're highly skeptical now after the laws that were passed, saying, well, we know you're a commercial organization, so you might sell the data. And actually, youngsters today seem to think that there's a social contract where that's okay. I personally don't. But with that Intelligence Act law in place, people think, well, could they be using the information for something else? Now, as it happens, I don't think it would be particularly useful what they get. But more importantly, when it comes to something like an election, what they could potentially do, and this is the bigger worry, is they could censor things or they could hype things up because they run the algorithms that push people towards certain information or push certain information to people. So imagine, I mean, your last election in the United States was determined by something like 80,000 votes. Imagine you could identify a large proportion of them and influence them one way or another. You're not breaking into the systems to change the tally, but you are potentially influencing people and the way they think just enough to change their vote. And that's why people are really quite concerned about platforms like TikTok.
Yeah, it's an upstream manipulation that could impact the downstream real-time result. Ladies and gentlemen, I could not be more fired up to introduce the presenting sponsor for season 2 of Change Agents, Montana Knife Company, founded by somebody that I feel very fortunate to call a personal friend, Master Bladesmith Josh Smith. Not only a Master Bladesmith, but the youngest Master Bladesmith and one of the most experienced in the world. Montana Knife Company blades are some of the finest that I've ever been able to get my hands on. They are the sharpest knife out of the box, and they're some of the easiest to resharpen when you dull the blade. I take them everywhere that I go. I have them in every vehicle that I own and every backpack that I ever take into the backcountry. Specifically, my favorite blade of theirs is the Speed Goat. It's lightweight, but so incredibly capable, I never leave home without it. If you're familiar with Montana Knife Company, you know it is often very difficult to get one of their blades because they sell out within minutes of being released. What you should be able to find in stock are the Blackfoot 2.0, Speed Goat, or a Stonewall Skinner. And if you use the code CHANGEAGENTS10, that's going to net you 10% off of your first order. Again, my personal favorite blade is the Speed Goat. If they have them in stock right now, don't mess around. Put it in your cart and complete the checkout. Montana Knife Company, they build working knives for working people. And like I said at the beginning, I could not be more proud to collaborate with them on Change Agents Season 2. Ladies and gentlemen, Four Branches Bourbon is the only spirits company founded by veterans from the Army, Navy, Marines, and Air Force. These veterans collaborated with a Bourbon Hall of Fame master distiller and legend to help them make their smooth but complex blend of 4-grain and 96-proof bourbon, blended and bottled in Bardstown, Kentucky. It is often said that bourbon without a story is just brown water, and this bourbon has a story with over 100 combined years of military service around the world. At Four Branches, they are not just crafting some of the finest bourbon, but they are reshaping the drinking narrative. Their motto, "Drink Honorably," embodies their ethos of sipping to remember, not to forget. And as veterans, we get to come home while others did not. So if you're going to drink, please drink honorably. And don't drink to forget, but let's sip to remember. And if you are going to sip and you like bourbon, this has a very interesting taste. Not that I'm a bourbon connoisseur or expert, but smoother than I thought it would be. I've had some bourbons that about ripped my face off. This was the exact opposite. So please enjoy honorably. If you want to learn more about Four Branches, please check out their story at fourbranches.com and pick up a bottle of their fine bourbon today using the code IRONCLAD10. That is all one word, iron, normal spelling, CLAD 10. You're going to get 10% off. Is there any truth? I've heard this said a few times, but I've never been able to actually get to the truth of it, probably because I haven't spent a whole lot of time researching it, but that in China, TikTok actually serves a far different purpose than the app that we have access to in the United States or the Western world, that it's much more restrictive. And I mean that from the sense of the type of information. It is based more from an educational approach or a tool that they can use to enhance knowledge or science or, you know, the STEM programs or whatever it may be. Whereas in the US, and I say this anecdotally just by watching mainly more of my daughter, that's certainly not its use or what it is being used for. It is an absolute black hole of attention.
I think in China, if you look at the way it's structured, the Douyin program, which is the equivalent app, they don't push certain information. What they do is it's the other way around. They block things that are not, they don't consider socially acceptable. They have moderators looking at things. I've seen examples, for example, of people live streaming on TikTok, and there was one guy who had a lot of tattoos. He was taken off after about 5 seconds, and it turned out they didn't like the fact that he had tattoos. They were socially unacceptable. And it's mostly tied up with the fact that China is entering this era where they have social credits. I'm sure you've heard of all about their social credit system. And it's, you know, what you put up on something like TikTok matters because it can affect your social credit. And your social credit score can then matter about where you can travel and, you know, what you can do. I mean, if you've got a camera every 100 meters and, you know, you tie it up with how people are behaving on something like that, it becomes it's quite dark what you can start to do with it. I don't think that's obviously what they're doing outside China because they can't. They haven't got the wherewithal to actually impose the repercussions of how people behave on there. But they are doing a lot, which, in fact, in the UK, only today, Ofcom, which is the Office for Communication, which is the regulator, published a report which was on three different video streaming platforms, of which TikTok was one, that Snapchat and Twitch was the other. And they were looking at how well they protect children from harm, and came to the conclusion that they were sort of obeying the letter of the law, but not necessarily the spirit of it. For example, TikTok would it wouldn't allow people who were under 13 to open up accounts, or just, and certainly people under certain ages to see certain material, etc. But it was by self-verification. So kind of, so what, you know?
Yeah.
I know undercover policemen that go into chat rooms and pretend to be 13-year-old girls. You know, you can be anybody you want online, and there's no verification. So that isn't going to work. And I suspect there's going to have to be, in the same way Facebook, for example, agreed not to carry any political advertising during elections, we don't necessarily have the same control over someone like TikTok. But I think we're going to have to start passing regulations. Otherwise, they are going to be able to affect the electoral process, the democratic process.
You know, people have these conversations about social media apps, and oftentimes they want to point towards an external enemy. It's China. It's somebody else. I wonder if the greater existential threat is an external enemy or our own government's ability to gather information on their citizens. I mean, you can look back to the old telecom days where on the West Coast and in the East Coast, you know, the hardwire cables that were going transatlantic, transpacific. And, you know, what did they find out? Oh, I don't know. NSA hardwire tap-ins right there looking at raw data. But of course, you know, we would never surveil our own citizens until the reports come out that they did. And then when they got in trouble for that, they would outsource it to an ally to look inward at the information so they could offshore it.
Yep.
I worry, and I don't know the answer. I mean, I would say in the U.S. right now, for most people, I think trust in the government is probably trending towards an all-time low.
Oh, it is in the UK. I think it is in many Western countries because people are discovering that they have been lied to so many times.
They have. And, you know, I can point to things about Snowden, the programs, you know, that he whistle-blew on and uncovered. They were never, I don't know, I'm sure they were designed to look externally, but they were looking internally as well. And I don't have an answer for it. I'm curious your thoughts is, what do you think the greater existential threat comes from? Is it external or internal?
I think they're all about the same, to be honest. I think one needs to be aware of them all. And the only advantage we've got with our own governments is that there should be democratic accountability. But yes, I mean, the one of the things that disturbs me is, amongst the Five Eyes groups, there is the cooperation of looking in on behalf of your own country is. I mean, you only have to look at where the undersea cables go, the undersea fibers go, and there's some maps, and they follow the old what was called the Imperial Telegraph routes, which were set up by Britain in the British Empire. There's one particular beach in Cornwall, a place called Bude, and not that where most of I think it's 25% of the internet traffic comes up on that beach. And not surprisingly, there's an establishment on the hill just up from it called GCHQ Bude. You know, it's in some ways they're not hiding this. I mean, but they are, you know, one of the things we've got in this country is a thing called the Investigatory Powers Act, which does prevent, you've got to have, to be able to use the capabilities to surveil a citizen inside the country, there are a number of checks and balances. Interestingly, that's under review at the moment. One of the things that went wrong, I personally think, in the United States was the Patriot Act. And after 9/11, George Bush called in the head of the NSA and just said, never again. And so a lot of what they had in place, which we've got in place here, they kind of, the Patriot Act, you know, the coach and horses went through that. I think the tail end of that is still there. So I would beware of what the US government is doing. I would beware of what the UK government's doing, because they have a history of, it was only in the 90s that they were public, that GCHQ, SIS and MI5 were publicly avowed. They didn't exist before that. There was a black vote. They got money from what was called the single intelligence account. There's a history of them not being open, I suppose. But the transparency is getting better. We actually now in the UK have an investigatory powers commissioner and a surveillance commissioner, and they write a report every year. And they talk about, they actually give the cases where something's been done that shouldn't have been done. And there's a couple of dozen of them every year. So that gives you some confidence that it's happening. But I just think in general, because of the, it's certainly in the UK, I could only talk in the UK for any confidence, but after all the nonsense we've had with things like Brexit, and the various wars that are going on, all sorts of things. You know, having had four prime ministers in 2 years, you just get to the point where everybody's so cynical about the political process, they don't trust them. They just don't trust them. And sadly, I think that's really bad for democracy. And one of the things, back in the old Cold War days, one of the foreign policy objectives of the old USSR, and I'm pretty sure it must be the same for Putin and Russia, is to basically get people to distrust democracy and say our system's better. And on the evidence, they're kind of doing quite a good job. So I think the governments need to fight back on that, but not in the way they're doing at the moment, because they're just making a lot of noise, doesn't actually, or blaming and pointing fingers. They've actually got, it's got to be the debate has to come out and say, look, this is what they're doing. This is their public, this is their foreign policy objective. Don't fall for it.
It's interesting you brought up the Patriot Act. And I think we can start there with what a great bit of branding. Who would be against? I mean, but truly, right? Who would stand up and argue against being a patriot?
Yeah.
But I don't think, and maybe from it has obviously grown in scope, size, and scale since that time. It's been renewed many times. I wonder though if people realized from when it was first signed into law to where we are now, the amount of privacy that they were going to be surrendering, if they would still be as supportive. And you mentioned it previously, that link tree analysis. What you're describing, when we are using signals intelligence overseas at my old job, I don't speak Arabic or the different versions of the languages in the countries, and we paid almost no attention to that. We obviously, there were people who were linguists doing that, but we were doing exactly what you described.
Yeah,
we could identify
traffic analysis. Yeah, totally. Traffic analysis is so powerful, and it allows you to. identify cells of malicious people, all sorts of things. I mean, it was developed, in the Second World War, and has never gone away. So
we could find a device or a IMEI number, and that would all it would take was to figure out who they were talking with electronically. We could determine at times whether or not they were physically located as well as communicating electronically. And from there it built. And to think that the US doesn't have the ability, I mean, this was in the early 2000s. So there's no reason to think that they didn't have the ability to do that then. I don't personally believe that there is a warehouse of individuals who are twisting their mustache and trying to observe and collect on Americans in real time. But I do believe that the infrastructure is big enough that the data can be collected and warehoused. And my concern is that that always could be rife. You know, you could go back and you can investigate it in the rearview mirror. So the volume of information that they have available is ultra concerning to me, because I do believe they can collect it in real time. And my concern is, what do they choose to do with that in the future?
Well, I think that you're spot on there. I mean, your NSA has the most extraordinary storage capabilities in their new data warehouse facilities in Ohio, costing a lot of money. They can just scoop it all up, vacuum it all up. And people say, I mean, one of the things I hear people say when I say, you know, mass surveillance is wrong, they should not just vacuum things up. If there's a reasonable suspicion that somebody's doing wrong, fine, get a warrant and surveil them. But don't just suck up everybody's. In fact, it's a human right. Article 12 of the UN Convention on Human Rights says that you've got a reasonable right to expect privacy. And it's only to be, it shouldn't be arbitrarily interfered with. Arbitrarily being the key word there. If someone's got cause, then fine. But people say, well, I've done nothing wrong, so I've got nothing to hide. Maybe today, but regimes change on a dime, as you say. Look what happened when, someone like Trump got in. I mean, there was a whole new dynamic in the politics. I mean, who knew where that was going to go?
Nobody is the answer.
Yeah. But I mean, regimes can change even in a democracy, and suddenly, you find yourself on the wrong side of the argument, and that data gets hauled out, and, they can be tasked with find me everybody that, attended rallies against me or something like that. That's frightening. That data could be kept, and again in the UK we've got legislation that says it shouldn't be happening. I'm pretty sure it's not happening because we just don't have the storage capabilities. But whether it's happening elsewhere, who knows? And it's also interesting that other countries would like to do it. But they don't have the capabilities, and it's all to do with the routing of the internet. I mean, Russia is a very good example of it. I mean, it must drive them spare that actually they're in a siding, really. I mean, whereas really all of the internet traffic passes through the US and the UK, and that's for purely historical reasons. So we've kind of got a strategic advantage from that perspective. But places like Iran and Russia, they would dearly love to have the data passing through there. So what ends up happening is certain parts of the internet infrastructure, in particular a thing called Border Gateway Protocol, which determines the sort of top level routing of which country something's going to, it quite often gets hijacked because it's all based on trust. And so you'll suddenly find, data that's supposed to be coming up on that beach in Cornwall is getting rerouted off to some unknown telecoms company in Russia. So so much of what happens on the internet is based on trust, that there's all sorts of shenanigans go on to try and get access to the data. But I think so far, UK and US have the prime position, the most strategic position, but it won't stop the others trying to do the same thing. But also, as you say, that data is in the hands of our government, and what might they do with that in the future?
There's a lot of things I like about the Mountain Tough program, but I think primarily what I enjoy is they focus on mental toughness in addition to just the physical toughness. Everything they do is grounded in one purpose: life transformations and being strong between the years in the mind. And there's also a community of 15,000 plus Mountain Tough athletes. So the community is strong, they're supportive, and they're going to help keep you accountable. So you can train anywhere, you can stream anywhere, you can access guided training and on-demand workouts right from your phone, your tablet, or TV or computer, whatever you're into. And everything you need is in one spot. The Mountain Tough subscription gets you access to all the Mountain Tough programs, new programs, and bonus content. And they have programs for everyone. Those who hit the gym and heavy weights, those who like to work out at home with no gear or minimal gear, and everything in between. Mountain Tough has been the trusted training by the dedicated for years now, including U.S. military special forces and dedicated backcountry hunters. There is no excuse for you to not start today. With Mountain Tough, you can conquer your goals with the ideal program for your lifestyle and schedule. Train with equipment or just your body weight on your phone, tablet, TV, or web browser. Most importantly, they will help you train your mindset so you are always ready for anything that life throws your way. Mountain Tough subscribers get full access to world-class home and gym programs, groundbreaking mental toughness training, self-improvement, prehab and rehab, biomechanical form coaching, stretching and mobility flows, nutrition guidance, challenge workouts, and the global Mountain Tough community. Mountain Tough is offering Change Agents listeners an incredible offer. You're going to get 40% off on the all-new Mountain Tough Plus annual subscription with the code CHANGEAGENTS. Go to mtntough.com and enter the code CHANGEAGENTS to receive 40% off, a savings of about $100 on your Mountain Tough Plus annual subscription. That is MTN, Mike Tango November, tough.com, and enter the code CHANGEAGENTS to save 40%. That is less than 50 cents per day for the best in-class physical and mental training.
This week on Borderland, an Ironclad original, we are going behind the scenes on the controversial crackdown on gangs in El Salvador.
He has enacted what is called a state of emergency. So basically, he has used political power to enact extreme legal measures, which basically removed restrictions on making arrests. So the state of emergency has suspended basic civil liberties, including the right to legal defense, due process, and that has basically given the state authorities the right to arrest whoever they want, whenever they want. That is basically what they did.
Watch Borderland wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube at This Is Ironclad.
To bring it back to even more of a day-to-day for people watching or listening, I think you and I can agree we do live in this digital world with social media and apps and all these things. And there is, let's just take it at the thinnest layer of the onion. You sign up for usage on these platforms, the end user agreement. What kind of data is being collected just on the average person, and how valuable is that data? What can be done with it, and how do these companies protect it?
Well, I can tell you Facebook, for example, because I ended up acting as an expert witness in court in a particular court case. And I reverse engineered a couple of years ago. What I'm telling you is a couple of years out of date, but I think it's probably still true. They were collecting, obviously, your name, your address, your age, all those sort of things, all the things to build a demographic marketing profile. But some things that are quite sensitive as well, like your sexual orientation, your religious beliefs, they're things that they start to, you think, why do they need that? Well, of course, again, it's just more demographic information. Mm-hmm. The bottom line is they will collect whatever they can. There's some stuff they collect as what you might think of standard, which even to me is the reason I don't use Facebook. But then they collect more through these other apps because there are on-platform apps. And, I mean, there was the famous case of an app called Cambridge Analytica,
Yes.
And they were just scooping up data as fast as they could. And not only from people that used the app or took the survey, but from their friends as well. So they will take what they can and as much of it. And some of it will be quite personal and what the data protection people call sensitive. But there's something quite cultural about it, because in the US, the sort of the authorities' attitude to data, personal data, is very different to Europe, UK. Here we have GDPR, for example, General Data Protective Regulations. I mean, in the US, if you subscribe to a magazine, the magazine will probably sell your name and address on to marketing data aggregators. They're just not allowed to do that here. So one has to remember that a lot of these social media companies are American. So their attitude to the data is driven by how data has been handled for years. It's seen as an asset that can be sold. It's harvested and sold. And that's that I'd mentioned the social contract earlier. That's the social contract that the youngsters don't realize they're entering. I mean, if you would spend weeks of your year if you read every set of terms and conditions, and I happen to know because I have read Facebook's terms and conditions, they're 13 pages long, spread over four different hyperlinks. So, you know, how you're expected to go through all of that as a just a general user, you won't. I mean, people get what's called, they get legal fatigue and they just click through things. You know, are you sure you just scroll to the end. Oh, right. Boink, that's it. And if asked, the company says, well, they scrolled all the way through it. They must have read it. You know, so that's their proof that you read it. And I think that's kind of disingenuous. It's sort of sharp practice, but it's not unexpected. But they will have other applications, even games, which will, you know, suck up more information about you, the way you behave, what you believe, what you choose. It's that sort of information that then is much more useful to the marketeers. And they will have games. I mean, GCHQ was one of the first to actually put adverts in games to say to people that were playing the game, come work for us. And you know, since that's happened, there are just much more sophisticated versions of that. So if you stop for a microsecond to look at a particular billboard or the equivalent of a billboard in a game, then it knows you've done that. So you must be interested. In the same way in Instagram, if you hover over a particular image, it will then send you more of that kind of image. So that's how the marketeers, that's how Facebook and Instagram and all the rest of them, that's how they build their profile of you. And also the Chinese apps as well, TikTok, etc. And how they build a profile of you. But it's not the sort of profile that people might be worried about, as in, you know, a detailed personal profile. You know, where do I go to? Who do I see? You know, what pub do I drink in? That sort of thing. It's much more about what can I sell you? What are you interested in? What are you in the market for? However, of course, data, it's like technology. It's got dual uses. So if an intelligence agency or a security agency has access to the same information, including who you play games with, for how long, you know, what you're both talking about in the game, yeah, you know, that's where the social profile starts to get built again. And that worries me more than just giving away my name and address and my telephone number.
So as an expert in the cybersecurity field, mm-hmm. what issues or threats keep you up at night?
Mostly it's the ones that I worry about are they're in two parts, really. I worry for other people about the fact that the vast majority of successful hacks And I think it's something like over 90% come down to what's called social engineering. And it's the same seven bad habits that we've all got and we fall for. So it's the swivel chair interface. We call it the picnic problem. The problem's in the chair, not in the computer. And it's so easy. I nearly got caught out myself actually today with a spoofing email that came in, which apparently was from PayPal and said, your PayPal account has been locked. I immediately looked at the email address and it seemed to say it was coming from paypal.com. And I very nearly clicked on the link to go and find out what had happened. And then I thought, hold on a minute. This email account is not the one that is used for my financial records because I have a separate email account and keep things separate, segregated. And then I looked at the domain very carefully. And it was very, very clever. They'd put it in as PayPal, but in the PayPal, the L was a one. And it just looked on a glance, it just looked you could. So, you know, one of the things is never click on the link in the email. Go to your browser and go to the actual one. That's you know, there are all sorts of simple social engineering ones. So those are the ones that I worry for other people. The ones that keep me up at night are where we're finding what's called supply chain attacks. Try and give you an example. There was a very good example in the very recent past called SolarWinds. And SolarWinds was a company that you've never heard of, but their networking software, a thing called Orion, is used in many, many very secure networks, including government networks, to monitor and to secure them. And what somebody had done was they had managed to get into the part of the software process where the software was built. So somebody writes the software in human readable form. It gets turned into what's called object code that the machine can understand, and then it gets built. So all these bits and pieces get put together. They get assembled into the main bit. And they had security processes in place to review the human readable code, to go through the object code, make sure nothing had been added, etc. What they didn't realize was that somebody got into the build part of the process and they were adding their little bit. They were injecting their little bit at that point. So what went out the door was infected. And once it was in people's networks, it was sculling around in that network and it was finding interesting things and it was phoning home and sending it back. We still don't know the full extent of the damage from that. But it turns out that there's quite a lot of those going on. And they're not like ransomware. They're not trying to disrupt something. Their motivation is collecting data. And to my mind, that must be a nation state doing that. Because the motivations are criminals do it for money. It's as simple as that. You get some hacktivists who are doing it to make a political point, but they tend to deface a website. If somebody's stealing data and there's no demand for money to get it back and it just disappears and being posted off to some mysterious server on the other side of the world, that's going to be a government. And particularly the SolarWinds one was a really good example of where they found a very, very, very clever way of getting into a large number of networks all at once. In a way that nobody had thought of before. And it's those rather unusual so-called zero-day attacks that have this sort of force multiplier effect that worry me, because we don't know. I mean, you don't know what you don't know.
So what I've taken from this conversation is, of course, after we're done recording this electronically, I'm going to smash everything that I have with a battery and go back to writing letters and maybe telegrams. But yeah. I mean, obviously, nobody's going to do that. We, like I said before, with the social media apps or even our reliance on electronics, we're through the looking glass. So I think it's more of a way of figuring how to manage and flourish and thrive in the environment that we are in.
I think one of the things one has to be is, I mean, you're either glass half empty or glass half full. And you do have to remember the glass half full bit. I mean, imagine the things that we're able to do. I'm able to talk to you from one side of the world to the other. which we couldn't have done before. I can stay in touch with friends all around the world. It allows me to do my banking without ever leaving the house, all sorts of things. So it does enable a huge amount of change in the way we operate day to day, and it does make our lives simpler. But we just have to be aware, there are elephant traps out there.
I agree. I also try to remind people that glasses are refillable. I hate binary choices. Yes. Is it a glass half empty or half full? I'm like, Well, let me take a sip and I'll put some more water back in it, or scotch, depending on what day of the week it is. I hate these binary questions. But what would you leave people with, closing thoughts on this topic? What would you want people to walk away from this conversation with?
Ooh, that's a tricky one. Because it's ever so easy to start giving, throw the kitchen sink in and all the rest of it.
Put your phone down the garbage disposal.
Yeah, I think when it comes to dealing with anybody on the internet, I ask people to practice what I call the ABCs, which is you assume nothing, you believe no one, and you check everything. And there's also a D, ABCD, which is if in doubt, just delete it. Because if it's that important, somebody will send it again.
Yep.
I think just practice your ABCs, and that protects you quite a lot of the time. It does mean that we all become a little bit more cynical, and you end up with people like me who are professional cynics. But sadly, I think when you're dealing with people and institutions that you never meet, you're not introduced to by anybody. You have to adopt that approach.
Hopefully you found today's episode to be thought-provoking and intriguing, and perhaps it took you to a place where you at least thought about, will maybe be a little bit more cautious with, or maybe even modify your usage of the internet or how you choose to share your data. To keep up with Professor Woodward and his work, the best medium to do so will be on X, which is formerly known as Twitter. His handle is @prof, P-R-O-F, Woodward. So the normal spelling of his name that is in the show notes. Thank you again for listening to Change Agents, an Ironclad original presented by Montana Knife Company. We're going to be back next week with an all new episode. I'll see you then. Today's episode of Change Agents is brought to you by the Navy SEAL Foundation. And they are special to me for obvious reasons. I have a genetic tie to them through my time in service, and I've actually worked with them on a variety of fundraising and charitable initiatives. Their entire mission is to provide critical support for warriors, veterans, and families of naval special warfare. Fundraising is really hard. It's hard to ask people for money, especially if you are asking them for a check with nothing in return. I wish I could say it would be as easy as pulling on somebody's heartstrings and they reach into their wallet and they give what they can. But oftentimes, people are hesitant to give unless they can see the tangible results of the money or they get something in return. So I'm about to offer you that opportunity. The Navy SEAL Foundation has just launched their winter apparel line, and they have everything that you need to stay warm because we're in the winter. So what better than supporting a charity, but also getting something to keep you warm in return. So you can step up your style while you're showing your support. Each purchase directly contributes to honoring Naval Special Warfare and their families. You can visit shop.navyseelfoundation.org to grab a gear now.